Food 360 with Mark Murphy is a production of iHeartRadio.
I want you to build little stories on your menus so it's more interesting and build some personality into the menu.
I would say, we don't really own Red Rooster. The guest is really telling us that better be on the menu.
Welcome to Food 360, the podcast that serves up some serious food for thought. I'm your host, Mark Murphy. Some of you may know me as a chef and a New York restaurateur. Today's episode is all about menus. Sure, a clever design and a cool-looking place is important, but a restaurant is nothing without a solid menu. My guests Marcus Samuelson and Greg Rapp, who you heard at the start of the show, both know a thing or two about that. I sat down first with Greg. He's been working in the menu engineering field for the past 36 years, and he has developed his own tools and strategies to help more than 1,000 restaurants and hotels build successful and profitable menus. Greg, thank you so much for joining me here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
My first question, when you go out to eat and you see other restaurant menus, what is the number one mistake people do?
The biggest mistake I see is when they put a price list on the right side, they'll list all the prices. So a guest will find the cheapest item and then read the menu that way. What I would do on a menu is put the description and then put a period and then two spaces and then put the price in the same font. That way, if you're looking for the cheapest item, you can find it, but you're not going to look at the menu for price. The other big mistake I see on menus is dollar signs. I've been taking those off menus for 37 years now. They just remind people of money. So say you have 150 menu items and they have $150 signs. If you remove those, it softens those prices.
Does that also count on wine menus as well?
Wine lists are the worst menus there are because they just give us the name of the wine and a price. And so the restaurateur tasted hundreds of wines and only a few wines end up on the list. A restaurateur should explain why that wine is on the list and tell the story behind it. That's what I love about iPad menus is iPad menus. Now you can get as much or as little information as you want.
So how does a menu influence what people are going to order?
Well, think about those restaurants in New York that you see that have the sandwich name is just a person's name, you know, in the delis. And you have to read all the ingredients to figure out what it is. So when the menu is laid out with strange names and it's not organized correctly, a person has to read the whole menu and they will overwhelm. And when a person overwhelms, they'll default to a menu item that is easy or what they had last time. Or, you know, when you go into these casual chain restaurants and they hand you a huge pile of menus and books and bar books and all of that, they go, oh, I know this place has a cheeseburger and a beer. Take all this work away and bring me a cheeseburger and a beer.
Right.
But if you organize the menu and a person can navigate it and find items, if they can go through their categories and they can go to a seafood section if they're interested in seafood, or they can go away from that seafood section if they aren't interested in seafood. And like I say, the sooner a person finds what they want, the more they'll typically order too. They'll order more in the pizza industry if they're putting the pizza together on their own instead of ordering a signature pizza. And they're arm wrestling with their whole family on what goes on the pizza today, they're not going to order as many salads or as many breadsticks. So the sooner we can help them order a signature pizza, the more they'll typically order.
So how you describe a dish is important. What makes a good description?
The best descriptions have the ingredients up front and then the copy about it at the end. You know, because a person, when they're looking over a menu, they're looking for what they want. And those ingredients are what are going to entice them into that item. And if they find something that they don't like, they'll move on to the next one. But if you put your copy at the front that you say, oh, this is the best, or something, that sell copy at the front of the description, they have to read through that to get to the ingredients. And a lazy menu is what I call when a chef just puts the ingredients and commas, and that's all it is. You know, it doesn't tell you anything about the food or the item or what it's about. And again, I want you to build little stories on your menus so it's more interesting and build some personality into the menu.
And then there's also something called decoy items on menus. What do those do?
Decoys are items when we put something crazy on the menu. I was working in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and the owner of the resort had a 50-foot yacht he was trying to sell. So we put the steak on the menu. It said New York steak with 50-foot yacht and a bottle of wine, and it was $425,000. And then underneath it, we put New York steak without yacht, $43 or whatever the price was. These things are what we call decoys. They get your brain screwed up in a sense and excited because it's unexpected and it's very fun and you can make a point with it. And when you look at a menu, you've got those seven items in each category that you have to determine which one of those do you want. And seven is the magic number that we use on menus because if you do eight or more items in a section, a person will overwhelm. You can look up the research on this. That's why phone numbers had seven numbers in it, because if they put eight or more, people couldn't remember the number. There's a lot of interesting research on the power of three. Even a car ad is using that now. But when we put three drinks, let's say, it makes it easier to order as they put their thought into what they're going to have.
Talking about the psychology behind names, so if you're going to use the name Grandma's Chicken Soup, is that going to influence a consumer if they're going to use words like that, or homemade ice cream?
Yeah, because it sounds better, and a person, when they read something, they taste what we tell them that they're tasting. It adds a halo of quality to it and says something about it. So you know that it was developed by somebody and it doesn't come out of a big commercial kitchen. So by naming the food, you're adding a story behind it and you're adding value to it. The more you write on a menu, the longer the description, the more value you have.
And what about this $10.99, $10.95? Are people really tricked that if it's $9.99 that it's not a $10? I don't quite see people not understanding that.
Let me walk you through my theories on this, okay? When 95 says, hey, we're a friendly little neighborhood place, come on in, sit down, we're glad you're here. 99, if you price it at 99, it says, hey, we're trying to trick you. It's only one penny off, so you don't trust that restaurateur as much. 95 is friendlier and nicer. Now, OO pricing, it's got a little snob appeal to it. It says, hey, if you can't afford it, why are you here sitting in that seat? And you take the OO away, and it's even got more of an attitude to it.
So when you go out to a restaurant, are you able to just sit there and order, or do you sort of look, oh, gosh, they really want me to do this, or they should do that? What do you look for when you go to a restaurant and you sit down?
When I go to a restaurant and sit down, I look for what I want, and I peruse a menu. We've got the latest eye tracking, so I can now tell how they read over a menu and what they focus on, and we look for the hot spots.
You mean to tell me that you have like a camera focused on somebody's eyes as they're looking at a menu, or is the menu looking back at people? And what does that mean?
We have these glasses that we put on a guest, and then they'll read the menu and then they'll order. And so we'll do some tests on new menus before they'll roll out. Typically, the chains have hired me to do this, and I haven't seen anyone else in the industry that is using the technology that we're using. It's the best. The old eye trackers had these big clunky glasses, and they were very cumbersome. But the newest, latest, coolest ones are hip and cool, and you put them on, and you can walk through the restaurant, and I can see what a person sees before they sit down, because, you know, maybe they walked by a table and saw
the burger.
Yeah, they saw something that they liked and they ordered it. And how much influence does that have is what we're trying to study too. But I then watch their eyes on how they go over a menu. And then I take 30 people and I take their eye tracking tape, in a sense, and layer it so I can find out where the hot spots are. It's fun, but it's complicated.
That's pretty interesting. I really want to thank you for coming in and chatting with me today. Now, I'm completely fascinated that you saw this job, you went out and you invented it for yourself, and you did the research that you did. I don't want you to give away all your secrets. We still want you to get hired to go do your consulting, which is really kind of cool.
Love it.
Greg, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
More on Food 360 right after this quick break. Welcome back to Food 360. I invited my next guest on the podcast because, well, wait till you hear me read his bio. You'll understand why. Marcus Samuelson's love for food started at a young age when he would cook in the kitchen with his grandmother. At 23, he became the youngest chef ever to receive a 3-star review from the New York Times for his work at New York's Aquavie. He was awarded James Beard Foundation's Rising Star Chef Award in 1999 and Best Chef in New York City Award in 2003. He won season 2 of Top Chef Masters and beat yours truly in a Chopped All-Stars with the judges competing. And he's opened several restaurants in New York and around the world, some of which we'll be talking about today. All right, Marcus, thank you so much for coming.
Do you hear that silent drum roll?
And then Marcus walks in the room. We had to do the drum roll.
No, I'm just very excited, and I want to say congrats to you, man. This is a big deal. You got good digs here.
I know. I got in a studio. We're in a fancy place downtown. I'm very excited to be here. So you were born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden. We both have a European background,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, we're both Euro trash.
We're both Euro trash. Yeah.
And we're big in Japan or something like that. Yeah.
When you think about Aquavir, you think about any restaurants, right? Pushing ingredients sometimes is something that we feel like we want to do because we want to educate our customers, but we still want them to feel comfortable. I have a really silly example. I've used it before, but on my menu at La Fourchette a long time ago, and I had this menu item. It was a cumin-scented carrots with some type of fish and a bel blanc. And it was a great dish because I love cumin.
Yeah.
And I wrote cumin on the menu.
Yeah.
Nobody bought it. And then I did the exact same dish. I took cumin off, and people were like, wow, this is really good. I love the flavor. What's that flavor? Like, they wouldn't order it because of cumin written on there. So for you, have you had that experience where you're like, I want to push the boundaries. I want to push my customer's palate's boundaries, but they're not going to know it until they're eating it.
Well, I think Scandinavian food today is a thing, but back when we were starting it, it wasn't a thing, right? So for me, it was all those Scandinavian flavors that could be very foreign to people. It was about, I couldn't have a foreign ingredient and a foreign technique. Like, I had to pick one, right? That's why we had so much salmon on the menu, because people could relate to that. But if I light smoked something, it was always about choices, right? About how do people understand Scandinavian food when there was no, really before internet and food, you know what I mean? So I used to say, Scandinavian food to me still is about building blocks. It's about pickling, preserving. It's about getting closer to nature, like foraging and all this stuff. It's also about game meats, right? And game meats, as we know as chefs, that it does taste differently. It might be tougher. It might be this different thing.
Totally.
So articulate that on a menu was always challenging. But then you also realize when you cook for somebody or something, that tribe might be smaller, but you know, you have a base to cook to. Almost like if you cook a regional Italian restaurant, right? You have that base to cook to. And that's what I always saw. Like, there are all these 50 Scandinavians a night that's going to come with one friend, and now we're like a little bit more, right? And that became the messaging, right? And you and I started also way before social media. So I think we weren't outed in a sense. Like, if we made a mistake, it was a mistake for that night, but we can go back tomorrow and fix it. It wasn't like, boom, on Insta right away. So it's a little bit more forgiving.
You really pushed the boundaries with Mercado 55. Yeah. And I remember going there because I had a little bit more money by the time you opened that place. So I was able to go. But that was African cuisine. Now, you pushed the boundaries.
Yeah.
I think I remember you doing a peanut soup. What was your mindset when you're going, okay, I got to write a menu, African flavors, and I'm downtown in the meatpacking district where nobody's really talking about food right back then.
Well, I mean, I thought, Mark, like this idea about Africa and Africa food, right? We're still searching for that because Africa is a billion people. There's about 50 plus nations. And, you know, Europe has done such a great way of articulating their history, both documenting it and talking about each country in terms of pride and history, rituals and food. When it comes to Africa, the authorship has been taken away. So like you would never say, a Portuguese person and a person from Poland should eat the same food, right? It's very clear, like what, you know, one is more herring and cabbage and one is more bacalhau and, you know, beautiful sardines and olive oils, right? If I would then open up the package between Nigeria and Angola, people would be like, what, huh? And still to this day, there is this misconception, yet 90% of all food stems from Africa. You think about that. So I think it was real about thinking about the authorship of things, right? Like the first wines came from the Egyptians, right? The first foie gras came from Africa. Things that we think about American food, like how we got rice to this country, okra, of course, and so on, it came from Africa. Yet the authorship is just separation. And even to modern time, if you would say to a friend, I'm going to give you some great Belgian chocolate. And he would be like, oh, that's great, cool. But where exactly is the coca bean in Belgium, right?
Well, it's like Swiss chocolate. Everybody talks about it. You're like, wait a minute, you're not growing that there.
Yeah, so there's like the authorship, there's no link, therefore.
So give me the list of countries you have restaurants right now. You obviously have restaurants in Sweden. I know you have a restaurant in London. You're obviously in New York City and in New Jersey, right? Mm-hmm. You've opened one in New Jersey.
I love that you think about New Jersey as a different country.
I do.
Yeah, we're in the middle of opening right now in Montreal with Four Seasons, which has been an amazing ride.
That's a different country too, right?
It is. All right, just and checking. It's also on top of that, they speak a language that you speak, French.
Well, the French don't think so, but okay, go ahead.
That's okay, good. I'm going to come back to that. No, but it's been, I feel like being a restaurant worker, being a chef, is the biggest privilege of my life. And be able to communicate with dishwasher, cooks, waiters, waitresses, customers, is such a big privilege. And for me to be able to do that lingo all over the world, it's hard. But it's also one of the things that actually, besides my son, my wife, that gets me up in the morning and be like, I'm really excited, Mark. And I know you're excited too. And we worked for such a long time. And for us to, I know you were excited coming down here tonight, today. I know that. I just know how you are. Mm-hmm. And that's such a privilege to be able to work with something and connect with people on different levels with something that you love. There's very few jobs that you can do that. And it's not a linear path. It doesn't make sense for anyone else but me and my team.
Right.
But I'm going to keep doing it with my tribe, with my team. And we're fortunate, people are coming still.
But when you're writing the menus to get them to come, when you're writing a restaurant menu in Sweden or you're writing it in New York, what differences do you find when you're writing those menus?
Well, I've been an immigrant 6 times, right? So, but it's also about then understanding what local means in those places. So when we speak in Stockholm, you can't open the restaurant without thinking about what sustainable conversation do you want to have. So one of our restaurant there is 30% of the menu is vegetarian. And that's a starting point for just starting.
So that's in Sweden. If I go to Sweden and open a restaurant without a third of my menu vegetarian, I will be closed.
Well, maybe not, but it's sustainable at least. So it's not a flash. It's you doing that, right? So I think there's a middle where everybody want to be, and it's sticky, and that's where everybody want to be. But local means that it's not a tag word. You actually have to slow everything down and have them then this dialogue with cooks and waiters and the team and be like,
And the neighborhood.
What matters here?
In Harlem, you've got chicken and waffles, you've got shrimp and grits, and you've got ramen and agua chile. I know you and I know the restaurant, and you're obviously, you can talk about it much more eloquently than I can, but there's a lot of neighborhoods up there. There's a lot of culture up there. And you reflecting that on the menu as a local restaurant.
That is the eloquent way of saying it, but I'm also just inspired by the Chop judges. So it's clearly there's a Ron and Amanda and a Mark and a Scott.
So you got to have one of each on the menu?
Yeah, okay. And the Jeffrey's clearly the most expensive. That's when the tomahawk comes in on the weekend.
Yeah.
Then there's Jeffrey.
With a lot of attitude. Let's just put that out there. But I think everybody knew that.
Yeah. No, but I mean, Harlem is a village in the city, right? It's its own neighborhood. It's truly a neighborhood. And East Harlem is very different. And East Harlem has 3 different neighborhoods. One is Puerto Rican, one is Mexican, and one started as a Jewish and Italian neighbor further east. That's why you got Rayos and, you know, Patsy started from there, right? So that's all representing that. And again, that makes sense to me, right? But from an outsider looking in, and once you're in that bar, in that place, it actually does make sense, but not from a website, not even from an Instagram. You kind of have to be in the thick of it. And we're so blessed. Like, we have, every year since we opened, our business has gone up. And it's not something I take lightly. I think it's all about being inclusive and being in and of that neighborhood. And it's not really, I always say, we don't really own Red Rooster. We have this lucky baton that we can manage and work here. And the guest is really telling us that better be on the menu, right? And it's this dialogue that I missed when I lived in Midtown, right? Like, I used to go home from Aqua Vita to walk home, and people were always nice, but no one really talked to you. No one really talked to me. And in Harlem, when I walk home those 5 blocks, like, why is that chicken $28? You know, my son needs to get a job there. The prices of the cocktail should go down, whatever it might be.
You hear something.
And my wife was like, Marcus, you stopped working now. Like, they should leave you alone. I said, listen, the one thing that is worse than this, it's complete silence. That means that no one cares. There's a privilege to have people in your face like that.
Totally. And as you were just talking about, the customers are telling you what to do. I've had experiences on my menus where I've put things on and I want to take them off and I get yelled at. But, and I know you had that. Yeah. Didn't you have something with the mac and cheese? Your mac and cheese, what do you put? You put collard greens in there or something?
Mac and greens.
Mac and greens.
Super healthy idea.
So, yeah.
Not a good idea.
So wait, but you took it off the menu and what happened? No. Were they protesting out front?
Yeah, there was definitely a protest, but we put it back on and then we put some options on it. But only when something matters will it be debated. And in that chaos, it's also the beauty of the restaurant. The soul of the restaurant comes in that chaos. It makes sense for no one else. It's not an office environment, right? It's really a restaurant. And that's, I think, it's that beautiful chaos that we really dream of as chefs, right? And those are the restaurants we want to be at.
And it's reflected in the staff. It's reflected in the menu. It's reflected in the food and the guests. All of it is just, it's a beautiful painting, what restaurants are. It's the most chaotic painting in the world. But talking about menu items, like you were just saying about your mac and cheese and you have to keep it on. Yeah. I had that problem when it was more of the press that did it to me. I remember I opened Landmark and I had this, it was just a silly dish. I took profiteroles. Instead of putting them in the dessert menu, I filled them with goat cheese and sweet garlic and
thyme. Well, you better
not. And I put three of them on a plate and I made a little salad with some roasted red peppers and frisée.
Nice.
And it was a good dish. I liked it. And then somebody wrote about it in the press.
Yeah.
And I was just about to take it off the menu. And then I couldn't take it off the menu.
That's great.
And then I tried to take it off the menu. And I was like, it was one of these things. I was like, this damn thing's going to be on the, and I think it was on the Landmark menu for close to 10 years until I was able to take it off. And finally, I'm like, I don't care what they say. I'm taking it
I'm
off.
Taking
I'm
it
sick
off.
Of it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm making this decision. Okay. And I'm not letting the press decide what I'm supposed to have on my menu, but it does. But you have to say between the press and between your customers, they dictate what you're going to have on your menu sometimes.
Cooking and being a chef, it's so much part of being the craftsman, but it's also an artist. And then you have to let that go and then send it out to, like, because now it's not yours anymore. Now it's the customers and the staff, right? And that's what we're still struggling with. Like, look, but, and what about this great dish? What is the greatest incredible dish that you felt that you've done
And
that didn't resonate.
But didn't work, exactly.
It didn't work.
You're sitting there eating this going, this is awesome. And you put it on the menu, it's like, oh, nobody wants this. One more question. Yeah. Substitutions on menus, okay? So this is the one thing that as a chef, because we like to control everything, when somebody tells me that I want the salmon set up with the chicken and the sauce from the steak, there's a reason why we're supposed to stay in the kitchen at that point. Because you're like, all right, I've created this dish not for you in the dining room to go screw it up. But what is your feeling on substitutions?
So I'm with you. We thought about the texture. We thought about the sauce. We put in the season. We know about the farmer who did it, right? And then somebody says that, exactly what you said. And in the restaurant, I'm like, okay, let's do it. All of that, right? To come down to, okay, I want you to be happy.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned, right? So that's what we're doing. But inside, it's like raging bull. It's like, you know, I've also learned, I remember the first time somebody pulled up a laptop in the dining room, right? So I'm like, and when people started to take pictures of the food, I was kind of like scratching my head. I'm like, what's happening here? Can you actually do that? And the server's like, he just did. And that was like 1 second for the server. But for me, it's like, wait a minute. That's not how we're supposed to dine. So we constantly are evolving.
We're evolving.
We're changing,
exactly.
Right? You don't want to be left on that island where, like, I told you so, right?
Oh, you're like the old grumpy French chef that's still by himself in the kitchen.
Well, there's more than the French.
Not just
you know
the French,
mean?
But exactly. All right, before I let you go, let's do a fun rapid fire round of questions. I'm going to ask you something and tell me the first thing that pops into your head. What is the best meal you've ever had?
The vegetarian tasting menu I had at Alain Ducasse in Monte Carlo. It's the best meal I've ever had, I would say.
What's the one thing on a menu that you will always order?
I always start with seafood starter. I love like crudo, sashimi, something like that. I always start light.
That's the Sweden in you.
Yeah, it is. It is probably it.
And what's the one thing on a menu you would never order?
Yeah, I am allergic to buckwheat. I got it later in life. I miss eating soba noodles and stuff like that. Other than that, I eat anything.
You're at it, What's the one thing you stay away from on a menu?
Supplements, actually.
You mean like chicken and a salad or something
like
that?
Yeah,
stay...
like, that was never really meant to be there. And I was like, no.
It was just meant to appease somebody that's going to try to change the menu, right? Yeah, yeah, you're probably right. Your favorite thing to cook at the restaurant?
I get very excited actually now about spring, right? Because like it is that.
It's all the colors.
Yeah, and, rhubarb is coming, rampt is coming, like all of that stuff, right? We get a giddy, especially after cold winter like this. I mean, now you have great salmon coming, great seafood coming from the West Coast. It's good stuff.
There's so many beautiful things out there. Three people alive or dead that you'd want to have a meal with?
Somebody that had helped me so much is Chef Charlie Trotter, and he did so much for American food, and the Chicago food scene would be completely different without him. Also, Nelson Mandela would be an amazing opportunity. I was supposed to do dinner a couple of times, and it just didn't work out. But so I would say those two. And then my grandma, Helga.
Oh.
We would talk food and different point of views. And
your grandma was a pretty big influence on you?
Huge. From also that idea that she was born very poor. She was a domestic laborer. Nobody asked her if she liked her job. But the food she cooked, her language, much more than talking, was food. Yeah.
And when you're cooking in the kitchen, what do you listen to?
It's a New York miss. It could be anything from Tribe Called Quest. But today we were actually listening to a little bit of Kiss. We were talking about Kiss, which is fun. And I'm all over the place with music. And I mean, David Bowie, Prince will be on, of course. But there's nothing wrong with a little Kiss before the makeup came off, not after. That's a very big difference.
There's a big difference?
A big difference, okay. Yeah.
Sounds good. Sounds good. All right, Marcus, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, my friend. I'm so proud of you. This is exciting.
Awesome.
All right, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
Thanks for
having me. Well, I hope you got something out of all that menu talk. I know I certainly did. I'm going to look at a menu a little differently when I go out next time. I want to thank Greg Rapp and Marcus Samuelson for joining me, and we'll see you next time. Food 360 is a production of iHeartRadio, and I'm your host, Mark Murphy. A very special thanks to Emily Carpin, my Director of Communications, and producers Nikki Etor and Christina Everett. Mixing and music by Anna Stumpf, and recording help from Julian Weller and Jacopo Benzo. Thank you to Beth Ann Macaluso and Kara Weissenstein for handling research. Food 360 is executive produced by Mengesh Hetikadur. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.